housekeeping because we threw this together. There is a handout, and hopefully no one had a problem getting the handout from the link. But if you did, give Ryan Malo an email in our office, and he'll send it as an attached PDF at rmalo@biancoresearch.com. Okay, today's call is Understanding What Happened. This is Understanding What Happened, I think, until the most recent, as hopefully there won't be any major announcements during the conference call that we'll have to adjust with. I want to take this in two parts. In the first part, I want to move all the way back to early July and talk a little bit about how we got from what happened in early July to the crisis point of last week. Then I want to talk a little bit about the plans that have been put in place and some explanations of them and the positives and negatives, and understand that the plans that were put in place have literally been thrown together on the fly, and they're changing as we speak. The money market plan, for instance, had a major change in an announcement last night to it. So these plans are all in flux, but I will do my best to explain them. And then I want to talk a little bit about last two things as to whether or not they're actually going to work. And my honest answer is I don't know if they're going to work. And my skepticism is because we've been down this road many times before with all the other ad hoc plans. Every other time we've done this, everybody said all the plans before were ad hoc. This one's comprehensive, the Fannie and Freddie bailout. All the other plans were ad hoc before. This one's comprehensive, the AIG bailout. We seem to keep repeating this over and over again, hoping that this one will actually work. And then lastly, the thing that we should be most concerned with is the law of unintended consequences. I've got some examples of it in the past, and this is going to be the mother of all unintended consequences. There is going to be things that no one considered happening, and it almost cannot be, especially from the banning on the short sale rule as well. So with that, let me move to page two, the summary conclusion. Everybody loves analogies. And so the analogy I want to start us with, and then I'll, at least on the first section, which I won't take too much time on, is to at least give us a little flavor as to why this is unfolding. And I think that giving us a flavor as to why it's unfolding helps us understand if the plan is going to work. An asteroid hit in early July and all the dinosaurs are dying. Fannie, Freddie, Lehman, Merrill, AIG, now Morgan Stanley and WaMu. Morgan Stanley now because they've become a commercial bank, which I'll talk about a little bit. I can add Goldman to the list. After the asteroid hit, the only food left for financial institutions are financial institutions that are light on mortgage holdings and get their funding from a retail deposit base. That was the move from Goldman and Morgan. The carry trade is now officially dead. The business model that was driven off the carry trade, investment banking, is dead. Everybody is now moving to try and get a funding from a retail deposit base, including Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, as they switch their business model to a lower return but more stable commercial bank. I still think that this is the beginning of the end, that over the next 3 months or so, this will be over with, and we'll then start looking at where to go from there. But the key here is that we have to survive this period. A lot of people have not survived this period. A lot more are not going to survive this period. I think the next big shocker, if you will become in early October when we get all the dear investor letters from the hedge funds that have had a horrific period during this time thanks to the banning of short selling. And then once we get past this period, that's the time to start making money. I've often said during this crisis that I would rather be a month late than a month early. I'm in no hurry right now to proclaim that the market is bottomed, it's over, and we're going to move forward from here, in large part because we've seen a lot of this in the past. In July, Fannie and Freddie had an explicit guarantee from the government. Merrill sold a bunch of illiquid debt to Lone Star, which is essentially what the government's doing. A market had opened up on this. And Fannie and Freddie had some of the best offerings that they've ever had, either in discount rate notes or in some of their two-year or three-year notes. But by September, the crisis was even bigger than we thought. So we've seen these kind of rebounds before. The question is whether or not they last. All right, page three. I want to go back to early July and say what happened in early July. I think it was the epiphany of Fanny, which is on page 3, and the epiphany of Freddie, which is on page 4. This is from our July 17th handout. I just pulled these two pages right out of it. And basically, if you go to page 4, it shows that on May 14th, Freddie released their fair value balance statement, balance sheet, and they had a negative net worth. Eventually, they released their June 30th one, and it also had a negative net worth as well, too. It was this growing realization that these two companies were insolvent that kept driving them down and driving them down. And then finally, by early July, if you go to page 5, foreigners gave up on GSE paper. Top chart on page 5, or the top panel on the chart on page 5, shows the monthly flows out of agency securities by all foreign countries, and the bottom chart just shows a rolling 12-month sum. $50 billion flowed out of agency securities. Foreigners were panicking out of agency securities in July to a degree unimaginable to anybody. The prior record was $5 billion in August of 98, which was the long-term capital crisis. And since then, we only had two other months where there was even an outflow period. So they were just wholesale panicked out of agency securities. What happened after that was we had the July 14th announcement that was Hank Paulson's famous bazooka, where they had the explicit guarantee on Fannie and Freddie. That guarantee was supposed to return confidence to the marketplace, but it did not return confidence to the marketplace. As the chart, as the quotes on the left there show, that as late as September 13th, there's still stories that foreigners still were not buying agency securities, even after the nationalization. And the last one was showing that David McCormick from the Treasury Department was basically calling giant financial institutions in Japan and asking them to stop selling those securities, that they were so panicked about that. So the negative equity finally built to the point where foreigners just cut and they said that was it. They were panicking out of GSE paper. Now, why didn't the dollar get crushed in this? Because what they did do is step up their treasury buying, so their overall levels didn't move. But what happened was they changed their mix quite a bit. I guess they decided that at some point GSE paper became a corporate bond instead of a treasury, that they had always viewed GSE paper as treasuries until we got to that point. Page 6, charts on the left on page 6 show the preferred stock of Fannie and Freddie. And the chart on the right shows the Wachovia preferred stock index that is of bank stocks. Fannie and Freddie, by the way, are not included in it. The top chart and the bottom chart on the right are the same chart. It's just different time frames. I was trying to figure out which one showed what I wanted better, and I had room, so I just put both charts in at the same time. The preferred stock, if you look at Fannie and Freddie on the left, collapsed down to its July 15th low, rebounded, but then continued to collapse down and made a lower low in late August. On September 5th is when the announcement came down that these two companies were being nationalized, and along with the nationalization, which was the plan at that point, the preferred stockholders were essentially bankrupted. You can see that the stock just traded down to about $2 a share because they were wiped out. This was the idea about the moral hazard, was to wipe out not only the stockholders, but the preferred stockholders. Richard Bookstaber wrote a book called Demon of Our Own Design. He used to be a risk manager at a lot of hedge funds and at Salomon Brothers. And his book was written last year, and he pointed out that in a tightly coupled system like we've seen on Wall Street, anytime you make any type of move, one move that you make has unintended consequences all over the place. And the unintended consequences of killing Fannie and Freddie's preferred stock just so that we could have some scalps and say, see, there is no moral hazard. Equity holders being preferred or common were going to get punished for this nationalization. If you look at the chart on the right, which is the bank's, the financial preferred stock index, it collapsed. The bottom chart probably shows that better. It fell 42% between September 5th and September 17th. And remember, Fannie and Freddie were not in this index. It collapsed. This important source of funding for the banks disappeared because preferred stock became at risk. So if you go to page 7, when Lehman Brothers, when the story came out, and there it is on the right, that KDB suspended talks with Lehman Brothers in an environment where the preferred stock market was collapsing. Lehman Brothers could not survive three more days after that announcement. There was no way that they could possibly raise capital, and the company didn't make it or barely made it to the end of the week before it was allowed to fail. Hank Paulson, in probably his biggest mistake to date, assured us that while letting Lehman fail, the system had 6 months to prepare for it. Everybody had a good handle on what it meant. He could not possibly have been more wrong in that with AIG, which is shown in the bottom, couldn't last 2 days from there. AIG's management also made some mistakes as well, too. The run from their premiums took them from needing $20 billion of capital on Saturday night to $85 billion by Tuesday afternoon when the Fed eventually stepped in and gave them the loan and took warrants for 85% of the company. But the mother of all crises was coming, and this is page 8, because the Treasury did not anticipate, or Paulson specifically did not anticipate, that there was a lot of money funds that held Lehman paper, that money funds would start to break the buck. The first one was the Reserve Fund that broke the buck on the 17th. Then we had some other funds from Mellon and from Putnam either close or reserve or break the buck as well, too. As the bottom story shows on Tuesday, the investors withdrew $89 billion from money funds by last Tuesday. Last Thursday, they were perceived to have withdrawn $180 billion. The charts I show here are the size of money funds, both retail and institutional. It comes from the Investment Company Institute. It's weekly data lagged a week, so it's the week before's data. We'll have to wait until this week to get the middle of last week's data and next week to see what the aftermath is. But I suspect you'll see that these charts took a bit of a dip lower. So the miscalculation of Lehman Brothers led to the devise of AIG and also led to the money markets breaking the buck, which eventually led to the insurance program. And then finally, what we call RTC2, and that's on page 9. But actually, it does have a name, or at least Paulson started using this name yesterday, TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program. Now, whether this name actually sticks is to remain to be seen, but that was the name that Paulson was using on the Sunday talk shows to describe it, was TARP. We like to call it RTC2, and I think the reason we want to call it RTC2 is because the RTC was perceived to be a success, when in reality, this plan is exactly the opposite of the RTC. It's actually more like the CIV-MLAC plan, but we don't want to call it that because that was not a success. So we're going to go into the history, find something that was a success, call it that, even though it doesn't look anything like it. Now, what do I mean by that? Remember that in the 1980s, hundreds of SNLs went bankrupt. They were taken over by the old SNL insurance fund, FISLIC, FSLIC, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. That eventually went bankrupt, and from there we created the Office of Thrift Supervision. The Resolution Trust Corporation's job was to take assets that were already nationalized by having these SNLs go bankrupt and then having them taken over by the insurance fund, and then take those assets and privatize them again. The current plan is to take private assets and nationalize them. So this is exactly the opposite of the old RTC. The only reason I think we call it that again is because that was perceived to be successful, and we want to attach or associate this with a successful program from the past. The original bill came out Saturday afternoon. The original bill was 3 pages long, and you can find it at the New York Times link here on page 9, and what's below is about half of what the bill says. This is it. The two major points that I think we want to bring up that I've heard people misunderstand about this TARP program is Section 6, and that's the whole section right there, maximum amount of authorized purchases. The Secretary's authority to purchase mortgage-related assets under this Act shall be limited to $700 billion outstanding at one time. Let me explain what this means. The Treasury is going to start a fund. That fund is going to have a limit of $700 billion. This fund is going to be, where are they going to get the $700 billion? They're going to sell Treasury securities in order to raise that $700 billion. There is no new agency. This will be part of the Treasury. Why no new agency? Well, my guess is they didn't feel they had the time to invent the TARP agency, write hundreds of pages of regulations, go on a roadshow and educate everybody on the debt that it would issue and how you would go about bidding it and what its terms and structures would be. They would rather leave this as part of the Department of Treasury and start issuing T-bills and in massive quantity the day after this bill gets passed. The bill also has that they will raise the debt limit by $700 billion as well, too. So when people say that this bill is $700 billion, in actuality, it's unlimited. All it means is that you can't own more than $700 billion in assets at any one time. So the Treasury could buy $700 billion worth of assets from the banking system, sell them off in the marketplace, take a loss on it, raise a little bit more money, buy another $700 billion, wash, rinse, and repeat, and do it over and over and over. They just can't do more than $700 at any one point. It's not that they stop at $700 billion. Now, they are functionally limited by the debt ceiling increase. The debt ceiling has been increased by $700 billion, so if they buy $700 billion, sell them and they have a loss and want to go back to $700 billion, they'll have to have another debt ceiling increase in order to do that, and that would be a political argument somewhere else down the line. The other thing about this act is that it does have a termination date. That's Section 9. Section 10 is the statutory limit on public debt, which is being raised by $700 billion. And Section 8, which is the one that's getting the most controversy, is that this may not be reviewed by any court or administrative agency. You can't prove that it is unconstitutional, but once that's been cleared up, or if it is cleared up, whatever decisions that they make is final and there's no recourse in court to go about it. So the Treasury is going to issue $700 billion worth of Treasury securities quickly. No wonder why Friday was the worst one-day period in the history of the Treasury market. The 10-year note lost over 3 points. It had never had a day where it had lost more than 2.5 points until Friday. That was actually March 8, 1996, a day where the payroll number was 700,000, way above expectations. And so we wiped out the Treasury market on Friday, and we're having another bad day today. 10-year yields are down, or 10-year bonds are down almost another point. They've lost a little over 4 points now. The 30-year has lost 4.5, approaching 5 points just between Friday and this morning. So we are destroying the Treasury market in this, and that would make sense because we're going to have a lot of supply. Now, we could argue about the crowding out theory as to whether or not it works. The difference here is they are going to raise this. They are going to raise this money as fast as humanly possible and drive us to our knees because they need the money. This isn't going to be, and they need it yesterday. This isn't going to be one of these things where we're going to have committees sit around and discuss what's the best way to do this. What is the long-term plan? The long-term plan is sell it yesterday and continue to sell it. Now, I suspect, as the way the Treasury works, is that the coupon issuances won't happen right away. They still are very leery about messing with coupon issuances, but that will eventually happen. So they'll probably start first, and it'll probably lead to a big flattening of the yield curve, at least initially, and then as the bills come due for reinvestment, they'll probably start to move out the coupon curve over time. But understand one big difference about this bill. There is no new authority. It is part of the Treasury. They are not going to raise taxes. This is a fund of $700 billion. They're going to raise $700 billion in debt, and then they're going to buy these securities with it, sell them, make more room to buy others. They just can't own more than $700 at any one moment. It's not that they're going to spend $700 and stop. It's just a limit on the number of assets that they can have under management. Then late last night, the chart or the text on page 9, they expanded the program again late last night. They expanded beyond mortgages. They're going to include credit cards, student loans, and any other car loans, any other troubled assets, basically any asset-backed security they want to have eligible. The original plan also said that it would be limited to financial institutions headquartered in the United States. Now it will be limited to financial institutions that have operations in the United States. So originally Saturday, I was wondering, does UBS qualify for this? Because under the original plan, it looked like they didn't. But now it does look like they do. So the big difference is this is not a spending program. This is an asset program. They're going to hire 5 to 10 managers. So when you get off the call, you could call the Treasury Department and submit your name in there, too, to be one of their asset managers. These asset managers will have a limit to the amount of assets that they can manage. Now, if this plan sounds familiar, go to page 10. It's because we already have two TARP programs, if you will, Fannie and Freddie. They were nationalized. They were nationalized, and they have portfolios. Freddie's portfolio is $800 billion. Fannie's portfolio is $750 billion. So basically, we're talking a little over $1.5 trillion is owned of more like conforming MBS and mortgages outright through Fannie and Freddie's portfolio. This would be a third program just like this. So we already have something along these lines. This is not new. It's just bigger, and it's going to be of lesser quality assets. Last thing to talk about with the TARP is how these assets are going to be acquired. They're going to be via what is called a reverse Dutch auction. In the reverse Dutch auction, what they're going to do is everybody's going to submit bids, and they're going to take the lowest price. Now, the problem here is that, as everybody knows, with most mortgage assets, almost every mortgage security is different from every other mortgage security. So when they wind up accepting the lowest bid outstanding, they're probably going to accept the worst collateral outstanding. The only reason that somebody's going to be willing to part with something at 5 cents or 10 cents on the dollar is because it's essentially worthless anyway. They're not going to be parting with all the good stuff. So all this idea that, and if you ask anybody in the mortgage market, all this idea that they'll put 30 cents on the dollar on this, every one of these securities is different. Every one of these securities deserves a different price. How do you do 30 cents on the dollar for the triple B tranche and the A tranche and the triple A tranche and the senior security tranche? You can't do it that way. So there's going to be a lot of really bad assets that are going to come onto their books as well, too. Page 11, the other original TARP is the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve also has an authority to buy up to $200 billion worth of mortgages. That was given to them last week. The Federal Reserve has been handing out collateralized loans to a great degree. This is essentially what the TARP program is. They're going to raise treasuries. We're going to fund them at treasury rates, and then they're going to use this stuff to buy these assets. Well, the Federal Reserve gives you a loan to buy these assets as well, too. The top chart on left shows total Federal Reserve bank credit. Last week, it jumped by something along the lines of about $60 billion. That is almost what it would do in a year. It jumped in 1 week. If you look at the bottom chart, the bottom left chart, you can see that we set a new record on open market purchases of our security repos on the 18th of $105 billion, took out the record in the days after September 11th. It's correctly pointed out that repos are the Fed puts money into the banking system, takes it out, puts it in, takes it out. Well, that's what the chart on the left show, on the right, the bottom right shows. The total amount of system repos outstanding and TAFs outstanding is around $275 billion. So the Fed has been doing quite a bit of this as well, too. And then the top right chart just shows that the result of all of these loans is that they've been dwindling their balance sheet down to nearly half of it is treasuries and the other half is collateralized loans. One of the other things we saw last week, if we turn to page 2 to page 12, was that the Treasury gave the Fed a $100 billion loan. Remember, they did a 34-day bill auction and a couple of other bill auctions in order to give the Fed $100 billion away from reserves. Why? Because they wanted to try and keep the Fed from over-reserving the banking system and driving the effective funds rate down to zero. They still want to try and maintain that effective rate somewhere near the target rate of 2%. The charts on page 12 just show that the discount window lending set a new record last week, whether you're looking at banks only, which is the bottom left chart at $22 billion, or if you add in the dealers too, it was $47 billion for the week, $60 on Wednesday alone. And securities lending still is hanging out there at around $125 billion. Okay, let me talk a little bit about, we've talked a little bit about the history of how we got here, explained a little bit about this TARP thing, where it is an asset program where it's limited to $700 billion, so they'll buy and sell, buy and sell. They'll hire 10 managers to do this. I want to talk a little bit about unintended consequences before I get into will it work. There's been a series of unintended consequences this year, and I tried to highlight some of them here on the chart on page 13. The first one was Congress raises the conforming limit on Fannie and Freddie to help unfreeze the mortgage market. Agency skyrocket, and the result was agency skyrocket, bringing down Bear and a host of hedge funds. Mortgage market still remains frozen. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the chart on page 13, you'll see that it shows the difference between jumbo mortgage rates and conforming mortgage rates. And they passed this bill in late January, early February. You see that January 23rd peak. It didn't work because the spread between mortgages and the spread between mortgages, conforming mortgages and jumbo mortgages, is wider now than it was before, and it helped to bring down Bear. After Bear, the Fed opened the TLSF, the Treasury Security Lending Program, to unfreeze the mortgage market, and that was shown in the chart on page 12. The result was Carlyle bankrupt as people rapidly arbitraged the difference between holding MBS and firms that can't access the new credit facility, and the market remains frozen. Carlyle Capital and a lot of other hedge funds had collateral that they could not send to the Fed. That collateral sold off hard versus other collateral, and it blew up a lot of these firms. GSE nationalization of preferred stocks, we talked about this on page 6. The crash of the preferred stock market accelerates Lehman's demise. And then Lehman's demise, which everybody told us was going to be no big deal, forced Merrill in the arms of BNA. AIG went under, and then they had to eventually bail out all of the money market funds. There will be a number of unintended consequences from what has happened in the last couple of weeks. Page 14 is my best guess at the unintended consequences, and this is guess. If I knew what they were, they'd be intended consequences. So let's go through a guess as to what they could be. The first one on the upper left is guaranteeing of the money funds. The rescue plan will come at a cost. The American Bankers Association noted Friday, and I think they're correct in their noting, is that deposits at financial institutions are insured by the FDIC up to $100,000. Money markets, which was the insurance for money market funds, is unlimited. So why wouldn't anybody with over $100,000, rush all of their money into a money market fund, creating a run on depository institutions? Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't happen, but we'll have to see whether or not it does. Then, last night, and it shows there on U.S. Treasury September 22nd on the left, on page 14, Treasury provides further clarity for the program, and they say it's a temporary program designed to provide coverage to shareholders for the amounts held by them in such funds as is the close of business on September 19th, 2008. So does that mean if I had $100,000 in a money market fund on September 19th, but then I had $150,000 in it 2 weeks later and my money fund broke the buck, I'm only insured for the amount that I had as of last Friday, not any new additional funds? If I switch my money market fund after September 19th, since I held zero in that new account on September 19th, have no insurance for these funds? Further details on other aspects of the temporary program and the required documentation for funds to participate will be provided in the coming days. In other words, don't ask the Treasury now. They're still making this up as they go along. Ban on short selling, page 14, upper right. Short selling. We had heard rumors that, there is no rumors on it. We'll have a market facts on this right after the conference call, but it's not hard to imagine that if you were a market maker in the options market, you had one of your worst days in history on Friday because it was triple witching. They banned short selling, and you had one of the biggest up opens in the history of the market. The losses that were taken by option market makers on Friday were among the worst that they've ever seen. And the rumors that we had heard was that they were going to not open the CBOE on Monday unless they got relief from the SEC. And that came 5 minutes before the close when they decided to lift the ban on option market makers. And so the problem here is that we've got losses, we've got a loss of liquidity, we've got a ban on short selling. What is the benefit of a hedge fund? What does a hedge fund bring to the table that no other type of business model can bring? And the answer is it can leverage and it can go short. Well, we've banned shorting on the financials and we're deleveraging. The hedge fund model is also blown up in a big way, too, because of the ban on short selling. And this is what I talked about before. I can only imagine in the coming weeks and months the dear investor letters that we're going to start seeing from the vast majority of hedge funds. See our News Clips product today or the Wall Street Journal. There's a story now that Meriwether's fund is down 26% for the year, and he's thinking about retiring all over again. What if it doesn't work? This week with George Stephanopoulos, Hank Paulson was asked that Stephanopoulos said that somebody described the plan to him as the last wrench in the toolbox. What if it doesn't work? And then Paulson responded, well, this is something that has to work. I very much believe it will work. Didn't deny, didn't say that that was an incorrect characterization, but he did at least admit that this plan has to work. Otherwise, if it doesn't, then we're going to have a real problem. Finally, on the chart on the bottom left, preventing deleveraging. This chart shows bond market dealer leverage, and it shows that as of April 2nd, the primary dealers, there are 20 of them on April 2nd, the primary dealers were collectively borrowing $1.5 trillion to finance all their positions. By July 16th, they had narrowed that down to $1.294 trillion. And currently, that number is around $1.343 trillion. It's a little table on the chart. Table on the chart shows the amount of dealer leverage, and that if you look at the difference column at the top, it says reduction in dealer leverage through September 10th is $219 billion. You can look at that at face value and say that's the deleveraging we're seeing, that the dealers are carrying $219 billion less of leverage now than they were on April 2nd. However, the TLSF was invented, and they've borrowed $121 billion from the Fed through that program. The TAF was increased by $70 billion. Dealer borrowings from the discount window is up $26 billion. So when you add all of that in, yes, they went down $219 billion, but at the same time, the dealers have borrowed something like $320 billion from the Fed, meaning that leverage actually went up during the period. It's just changed where it's come from, that they're borrowing more and more from the Federal Reserve, and they're borrowing less and less from the markets. So maybe this plan will actually get us the deleveraging that we want, and be careful, because I don't think we've seen a lot of it to date. It only really started last week in a big way. Will the plan work? Last section, page 15. The problem is loss of capital, not loss of liquidity. If the TARP plan is goal is to buy assets at market value, it's a useless plan. You could sell those assets now at market value. Merrill Lynch did that on July 28th when they sold their CDOs at 22 cents in the dollar to Lone Star with a loan on it as well, too. They financed 75% of it. But the fact of the matter is if you want to sell them at market value, you could sell them at market value anytime you want to any one of the hedge funds like Lone Star, whoever else is out there, ready, willing, and able to take them on your hands. Problem is you don't want to sell them at market value because you'll have to realize your losses and you may not even like the level that the market value is at. What we really need to do, if you look at the table on the top, is we need to close the gap between losses and capital raised. Financial institutions have lost $521 billion and raised $364. Next week, the third quarter is going to end. I'll open up a new block for the fourth quarter, and those numbers for the losses are going to go up dramatically as we continue third quarter losses as well, too. So we have not seen that gap of $160 billion could wind up being $260 billion or $300 billion. Add in all the other non-financial firms on the list, like shown on the bottom there. A lot of these have already been nationalized, AIG, Fannie, Freddie. And you could be looking at about $400 billion short of capital that these firms need. What these firms need is they need capital. They don't need a ready market. Now, one of the ways this plan can give them capital is if they buy these securities at above market values, and that way they can somewhat help recapitalize these financial firms. If they buy these at above market values, then they're going to violate one of the tenets of the plan. The rules say that you're supposed to protect taxpayers' interest as well as shareholder interest, but of course that means when you start talking about something like that, it remains to be seen as to how they define taxpayer interest. The second thing about this plan is that if they do buy them above market value and sell them below market value and the Treasury takes a loss, they may help to somewhat recapitalize the banking system. They may help to inspire confidence in the banking system so we can see more sovereign wealth funds and private equity firms commit capital to the financial system as well too. But the price we're going to pay be that sell-off that we've seen in treasuries and the dollar in gold. So we could wind up saying, okay, we're helping the banking system, but treasury yields are shooting through the roof, so mortgage rates, after we've done collapsing spreads, start right back up again. The dollar weakens quite a bit. We desperately need foreigners to play this game. They've already exited the GSE market. They've proven that they will stop buying U.S. securities. That's what happened in July, and that's what I think was the beginning of the end of all of this. And so we don't want to be too cavalier about the dollar, that a severe weakening in the dollar can have very dramatic consequences, especially on the back of a plan like this. So will it hurt? Well, the plan, I don't see it necessarily hurting as much, but I just see it being a little less effective than all the other plans. Now, my bias is I think it's going to be less effective because I've seen us talk about historic moves the week before with Lehman, days before with AIG, 2 weeks before with Fannie and Freddie, the same people that are applauding this plan as a bold, decisive move that will fix the problem, said that about AIG, said that about letting Lehman fail, said that about Fannie and Freddie, said that about the July move to explicitly guarantee Paulson's bazooka, GSE debt, said that about the failure of Bear Stearns, said that about the extraordinary moves that the Federal Reserve has done over and over again, said that about the loan modification program last year. None of those plans eventually worked. They stopped the bleeding for a while. And my thought was that always that this plan, that Paulson was dealt a bad hand and that nothing he was going to do was going to prevent this crisis. He was just able to change the timeline. And that's all he's been able to do is to change the timeline. Finally, last couple of charts. How do we know the plan is working? First place I would look would be the ABX indexes to see if they start to rally, because a lot of the paper that's in these indexes is going to get bought by the Treasury. If they wind up buying this stuff, let's see if these hedges get lifted. And if these hedges get lifted, then you should see the ABX index rally. That could be one sign that this plan is working. Page 17. Second sign that this plan is working is watch investment grade spreads. Look at the charts on the right. The top chart is investment grade spreads. The bottom chart is high yield spreads. September 5th, the day that Fannie and Freddie were nationalized, high yield spreads were at 855 basis points. They widened to the 18th to 983 basis points, roughly 128 basis points of widening. Normally, I did a little calculation. What would investment grade spreads do when high yield spreads widened 128 over about 2 weeks? They would widen about 30 or 40, about a quarter of that move. If you look at the top chart, investment grade spreads, they widened from 322 to 440. They widened 108 basis points over a two-week period, far and away. There's 10-year history. You see that two-week period is far and away the worst two-week period in the history of the investment grade market, and it widened almost basis point for basis point with high yield. Why was that? A lot of investment grade bonds through the CDS market get bought on leverage. And we only, I think, really started to deleverage in a major way last week, And so therefore, we started to see it really hit the investment grade market worse than the high yield market. If this plan is going to work, we should see some stabilization in investment grade spreads. Right now, we still have these spreads at panic levels. They're not at Thursday's levels, but they're still at panic levels. Page 18, the TED spread hit a new all-time record, even worse than after the stock market crash of 87, 313 basis points. Yesterday it was 213 basis points. On Friday it was 213 basis points. That would still be the fourth highest plot in history. While it's not at hyperventilating levels anymore, the TED spread is still at panic levels. It still needs to come down quite a bit. We still need to see a reversal of A2, P2 commercial paper, which is in the upper left. That might give us a sign that it's working. And then finally, on page 19 shows the relative performance of, it shows the relative performance of bank debt to overall debt. The chart on the left shows investment grade bank debt, which is the blue line, versus the overall Merrill Corporate Master Index. Normally from 1997 to last year, bank debt would trade at a lower OA overall index. Now it's trading at nearly 100 basis points more and an absolute spread of about 550 OAS. Considering it was down around 50 about 18 months ago, that is a move that is unprecedented anywhere I've seen in investment grade land. Same thing with high yield bank debt. High yield bank debt is trading 1,800 over, where we're about 900 over on the high yield index, or a premium of about 856 basis points. If this is going to work, bank debt should start to come back in too. Now, we will see in the days how this thing plays itself out. Remember, 2 weeks ago, after Fannie and Freddie the week before Fannie and Freddie were nationalized, they had a discount rate auction that went very, very well. And everybody said, see, Fannie and Freddie are going to make it. People are still buying their debt. They had the discount rate auction on that Monday. That Friday, they were nationalized. Then the following Tuesday, they did a two-year note deal. Everybody said, look at how oversubscribed the two-year note deal is. That shows us that we fixed the problem. We didn't even make it to the end of the week before Lehman Brothers needed to be bailed out. So we say this over and over again. Oh, this is it. This is the plan. This is a seminal plan. It's going to turn it around. It may be, but I've seen this too many times. I'm not sure how it's supposed to turn it around unless we grotesquely overpay for this stuff and saddle the U.S. Treasury with huge losses as to how it's going to help. Finally, the last three charts are just, we all know that the ultimate fix to this problem is going to be the home price market. Once home prices bottom, and I don't mean look like they're going to be bottom, I mean bottomed, ED, past tense, it's over, there's no more worsening in home prices, then we could really start to assess where we are. Here's some long-term charts to show just how bad the home price market has been, and now we know what the consequence of the worst home price market since the Depression is, the worst financial crisis since the Depression. The chart on page 21 show some measures that we would look at to see whether or not home prices are bottoming. The home builder stock index on the left, the home builder bonds on the right. Indeterminate is the way that I would look at these charts as to whether or not the market thinks that the home builders have bottomed, meaning home prices will bottom, because the home builders are still trading at a premium to the high yield index, and it's still hard to say whether or not that July 15th low was a low, was the low in the home builders or a low. And the chart on the lower left shows that starts and home builder confidence index, which is the blue line, continue to slump and haven't shown any kind of a rebound. And finally, if you look at absolute prices on page 22, looking at those on page 22, you see that there's no sign, at least, that prices are bottoming. Yes, you can look at the Case-Shiller 10 index and say that the rate of change is getting smaller, but they're still losing value. It's just losing value by a smaller degree. Existing home sales, as the Census Bureau calculates it on the right, is also showing that home prices continue to go lower. So finally, in conclusion, 4 points. How did we get here? I think that the beginning of the end was in July. It was when foreigners stopped buying GSE debt. That was the bazooka plan that Paulson had in July, was to get them to buy debt. They didn't start to buy that debt. Then the nationalization came in. They still didn't buy that debt. The nationalization plan had an error in it. It blew up the preferred market. That led to such a fragile situation that the Korean Development Bank only needed to say no, and Lehman was gone. The second big mistake that they made was letting Lehman go. They didn't realize it was going to blow up the money funds. It was going to lose confidence in AIG. They could have bailed out Lehman according to press reports, for $80 or $90 billion a week ago, but they wound up spending nearly $1 trillion by the end of the week because they didn't bail out Lehman. Now we've got the third plan that everybody says is a good idea, and we're holding our breath to see whether this one works. If all they're going to do is pay market value for stuff and turn around and sell it to somebody else at the same price, they haven't accomplished anything with this plan. If they're going to buy this stuff at above market value prices, sell it at a loss, and continue to do that over and over again as a backdoor way to recapitalize the banks, it might help on the margin. But really what has to happen is that private equity and sovereign wealth funds have to have enough confidence to put money in and recapitalize the banking system. Once that happens, then we will really be on the road to recovery. Finally, the unintended consequences. As I detailed before, we have had one almost every time we've had one of these plans, and those unintended consequences have been big and major. Now, by my count, we've got three of them going on at the same time. Not only do we have this TARP plan, which will spawn unintended consequences, possibly a weakening of the dollar, a rising of gold prices, a giant sell-off in treasuries. We've also got the money market bailout plan, which in theory could be a problem for depository institutions. Money markets have no limit on their insurance where depository institutions, it's $100,000. And we've got the ban on short selling. If a hedge fund's advantage is they can short and they can lever in a delevering environment where we've banned short selling on the financials, they have no business plan. And if they have no business plan, it's not going to be pretty what we're going to see through the rest of this quarter and into the fourth quarter from the hedge fund community. And we don't know what kind of a problem that will spawn as well, too. So be on the watch for unintended consequences. It's almost assured that we're going to start to see them. Okay, those are my comments on everything. It ran a lot longer than I thought, but I will take some questions. I will take questions in one of two ways. You can either ask me a question by hitting 7 pound on your phone live, or you can ask a question by hitting by sending me an email. You can either reply to the email that I sent on this call, or you can just send it to me at jbianco@biancoresearch.com. That's jbianco@biancoresearch.com. So that is the two ways that you can ask a question. So if anybody wants to ask any questions, they can ask them. Remember, lastly, that we do questions anonymously. We do them anonymously because we like to encourage questions. I know who you are, but I'll just refer to you by your first name. Let me start off with an email question from Dennis, and it says, why would the Treasury roll borrowings out the curve if the program only has a two-year life? Well, that's a good question, because the first question you have to think about is, do you actually believe that the program will only have a two-year life? The program will have to see whether or not, as it starts to get unfolding, if it has a two-year life. I suspect it will not have a two-year life, that it would be something longer than that. And remember that a lot of this stuff is also open to changes. They changed last night to the program by allowing foreign banks and expanding beyond mortgages in the plan as well, too. So as far as this plan goes, we could see more than a two-year life, but I do think that at some point they would have to kind of match the asset with the liability, because remember, the original plan called for them to hold this stuff to maturity. Well, the proposal that they have says that it will be extinguished in 2 years, so that's all in flux. So I suspect that when all of this is washed out, that this plan will have more than a two-year life, and that they'll have to fund it more appropriately than just taking the reinvestment risk with T-bills. But I do agree that they're not going to issue two-year notes right away. They're going to do a lot of bill auctions, and it could lead to a flattening of the curve. Next question from Alexi. Are you there? You're live, so we'll go with the next question.
Hi, Jim. My question is about using your analogy about the life in the ice age. I was wondering if any non-government financial institution will have a business plan. You mentioned hedge funds, you mentioned depository institutions, and I'm thinking that value investors won't be able to compete with the treasury bidding for distressed assets. And also, in terms of the length of this recession, if the Treasury supports the inflated home prices at today's level, can it cause like prolonged recession, Japanese style? What do you think?
Well, as far as your first question goes, yes. As far as the business plans go, let's say we did last week. We traded the potential of a catastrophe late last week and into this week by nationalizing whole parts of the U.S. financial markets because we didn't want them to go down hard and go down fast last week and into this week. We stopped that, but the cost is going to be subpar returns as we go forward from here. We are going to revamp the regulatory system. That's Paulson wants to do that, the 21st century regulator, as he calls it. When we revamp the financial system, we are going to wring risk out of the system. Don't take any risk, because even though it might be a good idea, you might lose money and the government will have to pay. We are even talking about there's a movement afoot that Barney Frank wants to put a proposal in this plan that any financial institution that sells securities to the Treasury under this plan would limit their CEO pay, and that would mean anybody's paying the firm, to $400,000. You couldn't make more than $400,000 as long as you're selling these securities to the Treasury, and they're talking about trying to up it to $1 million. Well, that would mean that the highest paid employee at any of these banks is going to make somewhere between $400,000 and $1 million. They're going to put a cap on CEO pay. Talk about driving all of your talent out of the firm as well, too. So we shall see where this plan goes. But you're right. The business plan for everybody from here has been trashed. And it's been trashed because we're going to wring risk-taking out. A lot of the business plans are dependent upon leverage. That leverage is gone. When the Treasury buys a lot of these securities, who are they going to sell them to? They're going to sell them to hedge funds. Well, a hedge fund's going to buy them 100 cents on the dollar? No, they're going to buy them with loans. Where are they going to get the loans? Merrill had to finance their own deal with Lone Star in order to get that done. I don't know what other hedge funds out there, if Wilbur Ross wants to buy some of this stuff, who's going to loan him the billions of dollars to buy this? So these are a lot of questions that still need to be answered. Lexi, did you have a follow-up to that?
I also asked about the house prices. If they are sustained at today's very high level, can it cause a very lengthy recession, as we saw in Japan when real estate prices were sustained by the government intervention?
I do think it can cause a very lengthy recession, and I do. I'm in the camp that I still think that we've been in a recession for quite a while. Remember that the fourth quarter was negative and that the second quarter's GDP numbers were artificially inflated by the stimulus package as well, too, and that a lot of people are looking at Q3 and Q4 as negative numbers as well, too. So I do think we're already in recession, and I do think that this will extend the recession of the U.S. economy. And yes, the Japan analogy is a good one, especially if this plan is supposed to be to support institutions that should fail. One of the arguments that people thought about with Lehman was that with Lehman they needed to let somebody go under, let the system revamp itself, and by letting the system revamping itself, we could remake it, unlike what Japan did, where they kept 80-year-olds in charge of insolvent institutions for decades on end, and that's why they could never really recover. But we changed all that around with AIG as well, too. Alexi, let me put you on, and let me go to, I got a whole bunch more of email questions, and let me try and take some of these one at a time. I will go for about another 5 or 6 minutes with these questions. There will be a transcript. I will include the answers to any of the other questions in the transcript in the Q&A section. And if you have any other questions, you can call me afterwards. But let me take some of these. Can you expand more on the Lehman went under? Why didn't they borrow from the Fed under the PDCF? Would borrowing from the Fed only have prolonged the pain? Lehman went under because the preferred market died, and with the preferred market dying because they busted Fannie and Freddie, they were not in a position to survive the Korean Development Bank walking away. That's my guess as to why they went under. If they had borrowed from the PDCF in a major way, I think that Lehman would have only lasted another week or so. Because had we seen a big jump from the PDCF, had we been to see a big jump at the discount window borrowings from brokers, because 2 weeks ago they were borrowing zero, we would have assumed it was Lehman. We would have assumed that Lehman was too weak in order to survive, so they were leaning on the Fed, and that would have accelerated the run. It would have just bought them 1 or maybe 2 weeks. And, of course, nobody knew that it was going to get this bad. You know, maybe Lehman would have been better off holding off for those 1 or 2 weeks to try and survive like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs did. The other interesting thing about Lehman, just as a tangential thing, I read this morning that Dick Fuld had $650 million in Lehman stock 2 years ago, and now it's worth $7 million. So his situation has dramatically changed. The next question comes from Dick, and Dick asks, the dollar. The dollar's under severe trouble right now. The dollar is under severe trouble because of the increase of obligation from the Treasury through this plan. The dollar is under trouble because the U.S. is going to have a credibility problem as we move forward from here. And I do think that we could continue to see a continued weakening of the U.S. dollar, a continued rally in gold. Remember that gold was up almost $100 last week, and gold took off, if you go back and look at a daily tick chart of gold, almost the moment they announced that the Treasury was giving a loan to the Fed. Once that happened, I think it really put the bottom in on the dollar on this move, and gold took off, because I had explained that as the Treasury is bailing out the Fed. In essence, what it really is that the Treasury is bailing out the Fed's target rate of 2%. Without that money from the Treasury, they'd never be able to hold the target rate on the funds rate at 2, and that is highly inflationary policy, and that gold, I think, was justified in rallying. Whether it should rally $50 or $100 remains open, and the dollar was definitely was correct in declining and will continue to decline. And we're also seeing, you know, the continued decline in treasuries because a lot of supply is coming. The next question is from Patrick. Do you see this accelerating the bottom in home prices? As you said below, the bottom in home prices with the bottom in the crisis. Does this program change the game? No, if anything, this program, if it works some, might slow down the process in the home market. Paulson has repeatedly said that in some ways his goal has been to try and slow down the process. Well, you've gotten that. By getting that slowing down in the process, you're not changing the process much at all. What you're doing is you're just changing the date that it happens, but everything that's happened would have happened. If housing prices are the key to the next question, I'm sorry, is from Carl. If housing prices are the key to underpinning the crisis, why don't they buy real estate owned from the banks and manage those longer term? This may help to halt the decline in the derivatives mortgage paper. At least we'd have something to show for our money. I agree that would be a plan. I also think another plan would be to just directly recapitalize the banking system, is to basically, you know, buy subordinated debt from the banking system that would count towards capital, and try and recapitalize the banking system in some kind of way. That's not the plan that they've tried to come about. It seems to be that since the beginning of this process, every one of these plans has been designed to provide liquidity, even though liquidity has not been the problem. It's been capital. As I explained the difference, liquidity is how efficiently you use your capital. If I have $5 billion of capital, but it's all in illiquid assets, it's inefficient capital. But by changing that $5 billion into cash, it's very efficient capital. The problem has been that the capital base of the financial system is shrinking. They're not doing anything to recapitalize that financial system as much as they are trying to provide liquidity. I think ultimately what they want to do is they want to let the sovereign wealth funds, the private equity funds, and investors recapitalize the system. They want to provide liquidity so that they can get to the point so that they get to the point where we go from there. Next question is from Peter. Peter says, why do you think the low is within 3 months? Many financial crises last much longer, and the government seems to want to push out the pain as long as possible. I think, let me be clear, the crisis doesn't end in 3 months. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear on this. That the low stock print, the high OAS spread, should be put in place within the next 3 months. And then you will, those markets should see their worst first. They should then start to recover, but the malaise caused by this will last a lot longer than 3 months. Remember that, in, you know, think about it in terms of equities, because we're all comfortable with that idea, is that with equities, you know, you want to buy at the bottom of the recession when things look their worst, because that's when stocks will recover, even though if you look at the real economy, it doesn't look like it's recovering. So I think that the low stock print, the high OAS will occur within 3 months, not so much the end of the crisis. From an investor standpoint, then I would want to start to be an investor in anticipation that we get some kind of a reversal. But given that they're going to wring risk out of the system, I'm not that optimistic that the reversal is going to give us huge returns because the risk-taking isn't going to be there. Amy asks, was the uptick rule reversed? Unless it was reversed during this conference call, the answer is no. What they did was they just outright banned any new short sales. If you had a short position on as of Thursday, you can keep it on, you can close it. You could not add a new short position. And so that's the problem there, is if you're trying to arbitrage convertible bonds, if you're trying to arbitrage puts and calls, and you cannot establish a new position, you cannot arbitrage those, and that would cause a whole bunch of problems. If you're a quant fund that's supposed to go long and short at the same time, they've cut half of your business out of you. And remember, it was quant funds last August that exploded that caused a crisis. So I only can imagine what's been happening in quant fund land. Two more questions. One from Daniel. No bottom in housing until the employment picture stabilizes. When employment goes up, credit cards and delinquencies also rise. Last night, the Fed expanded the collateral rule to include these ABSs. Could add several hundred billion more, depending on how bad the employment picture gets. Do you have a view on unemployment for 2009? Unemployment's going to go up in 2009. Unemployment's going to go up because it's a lagging indicator to the economy. It's a lagging indicator to the economy because I think that it will continue to do that. And you're right, they did expand the program, the credit cards and everything else. And remember that the program only says that they can hold $700 billion of assets at any given moment. So they can buy them from the banking system, sell them off to the private sector, sovereign wealth funds, free up that capital, buy more assets. So it's not limited to $700 billion. They can buy a lot more than that when they're done. It's just not at any one particular time. So that is the limits on it. And you're right, they have expanded it. And when we get off this call, we'll have to see if they've expanded it anymore. The final question I'll take, and then I'll answer the rest of them either individually or in the transcript, which we'll probably have out Wednesday morning. Why doesn't the Fed increase the amount of the FDIC will guarantee? Isn't it cheaper than the TARP and then get so much more needed capital and capital levels? That's another way to do it, but I think what they were looking at with the TARP auction is they were looking at an immediate crisis that needed immediate action. That's why this bill is 3 pages long. That's why it's not the typical 200 pages or 500 pages or 1,000 pages you would see with a bill. They want to get in there. They want to get this approved by the end of the week. They want to do bill auctions on Monday of next week, and they want to start buying on Tuesday. They want to get this going right away. To do something like increase the FDIC, well, that's just going to take too much time. They perceived that they needed to act quickly. And again, the last thought I would give you is the word that they seem to be using a lot with these is confidence. Confidence, confidence. Doesn't sound like they actually think this plan is going to fix the problem, but almost like they think that if everybody believes it's going to fix the problem, then they'll act like the problem is no longer there. All right, I ran a little bit longer than I wanted to. I want to thank everybody for being part of the call. There will be a rebroadcast of the call and a transcript coming out soon. And good luck out there with these historic times, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.